So I say that that was, a bit gruesome. I give you the warning, but the reality is that when we read scripture, we're going to find that that actually fails. It fails to show the extreme nature of what was happening. Okay, it doesn't even come close. And I say that because sometimes we can become so familiar with the cross, so familiar with the idea that Jesus was crucified, that we forget how brutal, how public, how humiliating, how painful it really was. I mean, if you think about it, here in the Philippines, images of the crucifixion are all over, right? You see it on walls, you can see it on dashboards. Just if you ever get into a taxi, you'll probably see it somewhere. You'll see it on storefronts, and it almost becomes background noise. You know when there's background noise, so you don't even notice it anymore? It's no big deal. But the reality is, no plastic statue, no painted screen or scene is ever going to capture the brutal reality of what was happening. And the crucifix that is so common in this country, Jesus looks. He looks okay. He looks like he's kind of still got it together. He's got some clothes on him. They make him have a little modesty. And it was anything but that. Anything but that. We need to remember that as we look at Matthew chapter 27, verses 27 to 44, that what we're looking at isn't an illustration, it's not a symbol, but we are watching not just a man die, but the Son of God be mocked, tortured, crucified. And he's being mocked, tortured, and crucified by the people that he came to love and to serve. The people that he came to love and to serve and to save. So we're not looking at a symbol, but we're looking at the actual physical suffering of Christ. And we've been looking at this for a few weeks now as we've been working our way through Matthew, and we've seen this crucifixion account. And last week we saw the problem that Pilate had. Where, what am I going to do with Jesus? I think he's an innocent man. I don't really want to deal with this. I want someone else to make the decision. And we saw that that just didn't work for him. He tried to get away from his responsibility and he asked the crowd, well, do you want me to release this terrible criminal who has murdered and stolen? Or do you want me to release the peaceful teacher, preacher, healer? And he thought for sure they'll release Jesus. They're not going to take this criminal, the murderer, but that didn't work. They released Barabbas. And in doing so, we see that what the Bible said in John chapter 1, verse 11 is very true, where it says, he came to his own, Jesus came to his own, and his own did not receive him. Not only did they not receive him, but they rejected him violently. Like, if you ever come to my house, you might find I don't receive you, but I'm never going to reject you with that kind of violence. So, Matthew chapter 27, verse 27. It says, then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the praetorium, and he gathered the whole garrison around him. We're going to stop just right there. So, what's going on? What's going on here? Pilate's soldiers, the governor's soldiers, they grab Jesus. It says they bring him to the praetorium. When I hear the word praetorium, you think like Colosseum, right? You think it's some crazy thing, but it's just Pilate's house. Now, I think it was an impressive house. It was a palace that was actually originally built for Herod, so I'm sure it was impressive. But he's brought to Pilate's house, brought to the palace, really, of Pilate. And it says that there is a garrison. And if you just read that, it'd be really easy to read that, pass by, and it's like, oh, there's a soldier. There's some garrison there. No, you can look into the history of how many soldiers a garrison would be. 600 soldiers. And it says the whole garrison was there. Why would they get 600 soldiers for one criminal? One criminal who had proven himself to be pretty cooperative. He's not fighting, he's actually cooperating with what's going on, and yet they bring 600 soldiers. This seems like a lot for one weakened man. Seems like overkill to me, but that's what Jesus is going through. He's being marched throughout Jerusalem by 600 soldiers, looking to be under their control. And what do these soldiers do? Verse 28, and they stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him. They strip him naked. Okay, here is Jesus Christ, God, come as a man. And they rip his clothes off of him. And history records that this was pretty common to those that would experience crucifixion. Because for the Romans, if they were going to crucify someone, they didn't just want to kill them. They didn't just want to end their life. They wanted to do it painfully, but also humiliating. They wanted to tear any kind of dignity, any kind of self-respect from anybody that would go through such an experience. So here he's got this public nudity added to this. And you see, oh no, they gave him different clothes. They just gave him different clothes. And they gave him this scarlet robe. And you might think that they're being kind there. Like, oh, we took your clothes. We're going to give you this scarlet robe. No, that's not a sign of compassion. They're not trying to lessen the disgrace that Jesus might be feeling. But they thought that Jesus wasn't quite humiliated enough when he was there naked in front of all these men. They thought, you know what's really going to humiliate this guy who's claiming to be king? Let's give him the robe of a king. So we'll give him this scarlet robe. Give him a little bit more shame. In verse 29, when they had twisted a crown of thorns, they put it on his head, and they put a reed in his right hand, and they bowed the knee before him, and they mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." Then they spat on him, and they took the reed, and they struck him on the head. So if you thought they were giving him the robe to be nice, these verses make it very clear that's not what was happening. So now they're going to give him a crown and this reed. Well, emperors such as Caesar or kings such as Herod, they would always have impressive crowns, usually not made out of thorns that will stab them in the eye, but gold that would demand the attention and the respect and give them authority. And remember, Jesus was being accused as being the king of the Jews. That's what they were holding against him. That was the crime he was found guilty of, that he's the king of the Jews. So they think, well, I know, let's make this guy a crown. But let's make it out of thorns so that every time Jesus moves, something sharp digs into his skin and causes some more pain, some more physical torment, as if they hadn't caused enough already. As we've seen, they've already done enough to him, but they aren't content. And then they give him a scepter. Okay, that's the rod that you'll sometimes see kings holding. And it's usually a sign of authority and power. But instead, they give him a dried out wooden reed. So that doesn't look very impressive, right? They're trying to humiliate him. They're trying to bring great shame to him. That's what's happening. And the added benefit of giving him this scepter, this reed, you can see the added benefit of giving him this, not just to make him look stupid, then they can also rip it out of his hand and hit him in the face with it whenever they want. Well, they're spitting on him. Now, if we were just talking about a criminal experiencing this, at this point, we'd be kind of outraged. Like, I don't know if you know this, but most, you know, developed countries that have any kind of at all fair judicial system don't treat criminals this way anymore. But remember, this isn't some common criminal. Not only is this an innocent man, this is the Son of God. This is Jesus Christ. This should leave us outraged. This is astonishing. I started to look up synonyms for disgusting because I was trying to figure out how can I describe how terrible it is what these guys were doing. And I found that there was no word that I found that I thought fit the severity of what these men were doing. The best one I got, I made a whole list of them, I won't share them all, but the best one I got was sadistic. You guys know what sadistic means? That describes someone who gets pleasure from causing pain, suffering, and humiliation of others. This was barbaric. It was humiliating. It was vicious. It was gross. You can look up all the adjectives you want, and you can pile them all together and list them all, and I don't think it'll begin to describe how evil and wrong this was. Again, it would have been evil and wrong even if he was guilty. And yet, he wasn't. And yet, he wasn't. So we can list words here all night, and it would fail to begin to describe the disgusting nature of what they were doing. They're saying, you say you're a king. If you're a king, you should look like it. Here's a robe, and it's scarlet. That's the color of royalty. Wear this robe, and here's this crown. It might hurt as I push it onto your head, as I twist it around your forehead. You might get a little blood in your eye, Jesus, but, you know, too bad. Well, here's a scepter so you can show how powerful you are. Actually, wait a minute. Give that back to me. Let me hit you in the face. And that's not humiliating enough, so let me spit on you. Let me spit on you. And you know what's interesting is Matthew goes through that pretty quick. Like, if you just read through this, you'd kind of fail to, if you don't slow down, you'd kind of fail to imagine how terrible this really was. But what a picture that this makes in our minds. Then in verse 31, and when they had mocked him, they took the robe off, they put his own clothes back on him. So they give him his clothes back, and they led him away to be crucified. Okay, so now they've had their fun. They've had the mockery. They've had the beatings. They've had the crown of thorns. They finally decide it's time to get on with why we're here. Okay, the entertainment is over. Let's move on to killing him like we were here to do in the first place. And here we see kind of this, the full disgusting nature of this justice coming onto Jesus as the target. But before we go on, consider the image we have here, because Matthew has already told us that Jesus was scourged. And we read that verse last week. Back in verse 27 or 26, it says that then they released Barabbas and they scourged Jesus. They scourged him. Well, what's that? What does it mean to have been scourged? Well, this was a whipping beyond what we can really imagine. Okay, the Romans would do this, and they studied and practiced for how they could hurt people the most, torment them the most. This is torture. If they had Jesus scourged, this would be brutal and severe. They would use, you're probably familiar with this, you'll see the picture of what they use. It was called a flagrum, which is leather whips, which that sounds bad enough. Like, no one's signing up to be beat with these leather whips. But they would braid into those whips lead, broken glass, bones, so that when they would hit your back, they would dig in. So that when they would pull back, it would rip skin from your shoulders. Okay, it would rip the skin off of you. And what they would do is they would tie you to a pole, because if they didn't, their fun would be over too quick, because you would probably pass out and fall over. But if they tie you to a pole, they can keep doing it even if you pass out. So the physical effects are pretty horrific. Skin and muscle is torn open. There's records that this would usually be so bad that muscles would be hanging out. A lot of times bone would be exposed, even internal organs. And you might think, well, Jesus must not have experienced that, because we know he had to march still till Golgotha. Well, evidently he did experience it, because in the book of Isaiah, it says what Jesus looked like. Says this is what Jesus looked like when it was happening. He was beaten beyond recognition, but it doesn't say he was beaten beyond recognition where you looked at him and you're like, well, I don't know, is that John? Is that Peter? Is it Jesus? It says that you couldn't tell not who he was, but what he was. It's like he's so bloodied, we don't even know what this is anymore. So this was severe. The physical results horrific. Victims would go into something that I don't even know what it is, and it's hypovolemic shock. Basically, you lose so much blood, I don't know what it is. It sounds bad. Sounds bad. For Jesus, that's what had happened before they mocked him. So as you can imagine, he's probably barely conscious. And that's what they're doing to him. And there obviously would have been psychological and social impact on that, right? It wasn't just painful, but it was humiliating. It was designed to strip away dignity as much as it was designed to strip away skin. You would imagine, if you saw that, you would think that would bring out some sympathy. You would think it would bring out sympathy. And instead, it brought out that brutal, mocking treatment. When you read in the Old Testament, you can find lots of prophecy, messianic prophecy. And we've covered a lot of these as we've gone through Matthew, because Matthew spends a lot of time making it clear that Jesus fulfilled those messianic prophecy. And one of them is in Psalm chapter 69, verse 20. And this is what the Messiah says. Their insults have broken my heart. I am in despair. If only one person would show some pity, if only one would turn and comfort me. And that's speaking of the state of mind of Jesus as he's experiencing this, which is crazy to me, because if I'm Jesus at this time, I'm thinking about the physical pain. But no, he's thinking about the rejection of the hearts of the people around him. And there we start to see, I shouldn't say start to see, it's been on full display, but there is yet another sighting of this love that Jesus displayed, that he would go through this. And what was it that so bothered him? Was their rejection. And he says, if only one person would show me pity. So he wanted some comfort, but their mocking broke his heart. So, Jesus has already explained, we saw this a couple weeks ago, he already explained that no one can take his life. He says, I have the authority to lay down my life and to pick it back up again. Remember in the garden when Peter was going to try to defend him, he says, Peter, if I wanted to stop this, I could. I could call 10,000 angels and I'd be done with this in a second. He could have ended this with a word, but he didn't. What is he doing here? Why would he endure this? Why would he put up with this? And we know the answer. Well, because he wanted to save us. Because he needed to take the punishment. We know that answer. And I'm afraid that the familiarity being so common, knowing that answer, that we forget to realize how incredible it is. Why would he undergo these scourgings? Why would he put up with the mocking? Why would he not kill these guys? Because he desires to save, because he loves to save. That's what he does. For God so loved the world that he gave up his son. Verse 32. Now as they came out, they found a man of Cyrene, Simon by name. Him they compelled to bear his cross. So those who were condemned to be crucified were forced to carry the cross, and it would be the horizontal piece. The vertical piece would be left in the ground, but they would have to carry that horizontal piece. Which would weigh, I've got to do quick math here, because, you know, as an American, I made my notes in pounds, and now I'm like, wait a second, I should talk in kilograms. It would have been about 50 kilograms. So not unbearable, except he had to walk about 3/4 of a kilometer. I did that math faster. He had to walk about 3/4 of a kilometer. Will you walk 3/4 of a kilometer with 100 pounds on your back? That's not much fun. You do that after being whipped to the point that your organs are hanging out? That goes from not being much fun to being humanly impossible. Right? Jesus had already given it all. He had nothing left to give, humanly speaking. He had nothing left to give. And that's why this Simon guy comes into the picture. The Roman soldiers are like, Jesus is never going to make it. He won't be able to carry this. We don't want to have to carry it. So let's make Simon the Cyrene, which that would have been from northern Africa. Let's make him carry this. And the Roman soldiers had every legal right to do this. They could compel anyone to carry a burden for up to 1 mile. Well, they're only going 3/4 of a kilometer, so it's less than a mile, which means they had every right to force Simon to carry this. So Simon is legally required to do this, or else he would face a criminal penalty. So they find this guy and make him carry the cross. And it just seems kind of crazy, because if it wasn't for Simon happening to walk by right now, we wouldn't have ever heard of him. But you know something interesting about Simon the Cyrene? Is we have every reason to believe that although here we see him follow Jesus to where he's crucified, he didn't stop following Jesus there. In Mark, at the end of Mark's gospel, we find that Simon the Cyrene was the father of two guys named Alexander and Rufus. We don't know a lot about them. We know very little about them, but evidently we know that the early church would have known them. That's why Mark writes that, oh, this is the dad of Alexander and Rufus. You all know him. And with that little comment, we find that it's very likely, I would say very probable, that Simon and his family became followers of Jesus. I don't know if that was a result of what happened here, but I kind of think so. Why? Because here we have a reminder that even a small unexpected encounter with Jesus can change a life forever. A small unexpected encounter with Jesus can change a life forever. So Simon carries this cross, because Jesus can't. Jesus has already given all he had. So he's compelled. And in verse 33, it says, then when they had come to the place called Golgotha, that is to say the place of a skull, they gave him sour wine mingled with gall to drink. And when he had tasted it, he would not drink. Okay, so Simon's out of the picture now. We're back to Jesus. They get to the place of the crucifixion, the place called Golgotha, the place of the skull. And it says that they gave him sour wine. It's mixed with something called gall, which we don't know a lot about what this is, but it would have been some kind of thing used as a painkiller. Well, if you drink this, it will lessen your pain. It won't hurt so bad. You'll be able to endure a little bit more. And we don't know for sure who gave it to them. We don't know for sure who it was that gave this to Jesus. And I bring that up because at first you're like, why would the soldiers now all of a sudden care about Jesus? Why would they want to help him feel a little better? After they've tried to cause as much pain as possible, do you really think they want to take away some pain now? Well, I don't think so. However, maybe they gave it to him so that he would keep going. Well, if we don't give him something, he's never going to make it. We want to torture him a little bit more. We want him to make it to the cross. We want to be able to kill him, so I guess we'll give him a little painkiller to get through. Or perhaps it wasn't the soldiers. Perhaps it might have been some followers of Jesus who were there. You can read about historical practice would be that it would have been somewhat common for some of the women of Israel at the time to go and try to offer a little bit of mercy to these people who would be crucified. So we don't know who gave it to him, but I can tell you that if it was the soldiers, it wasn't because they cared about Jesus. It wasn't because they wanted him to feel better. But once Jesus lifts it to his mouth, he can tell, wait a minute, this isn't just normal wine. This has something mixed in it. If I drink this, it's going to lessen the severity of the punishment that I'm going to receive. So he refuses to drink it, right? Because Jesus says, I'm going to experience this suffering, this punishment, fully and completely. I'm not here to avoid it. I'm here to take it all. I'm not trying to lower the severity of the punishment that God here desires for me to have. If you remember Jesus here, he's going to experience the wrath of God, and he needs to experience it in full, or else you and I are without hope. So God wants him to suffer, and because of that, Jesus is going to suffer. Verse 35, then they crucified him. It's crazy. You know why? Because it's like four words. Then they crucified him. It's four words, and three of them are real short. Then they and him. The original language, the way that they would write, there was only two words. So Matthew doesn't here explain all the gruesome details of what would happen. Why? Well, I would say a couple reasons. Number one, because the readers of this that he would have been addressing originally, they were fully aware of what crucifixion included. At this point, the Romans would have crucified 30,000 people already. It was normal. They crucified people along the road so that others would see the gruesome, disgusting, painful nature of what happened and be deterred from committing crimes that might lead to that same kind of punishment. Right? If you see someone being crucified and you know if I commit a crime, that's going to happen to me, you're probably not going to do it. So they would do it publicly. They knew what it included. They had seen the organs hanging out. Jesus, from the beginning, he knew what was coming. He knew this was the painful death that he was going to expect, and that didn't deter him. You know, he walked these streets. He'd seen it, but it didn't stop him. It didn't stop him. So Matthew doesn't get into the details, and I won't get lost in them, but we're not as familiar, so I do think it's worth knowing a little bit. Okay, crucifixion would result in having dislocated soldiers. I can't say that word today, guys. Shoulders. But if I say it fast, you guys might not even notice. Okay, their shoulders would end up ripped out of the socket because they're holding their weight. So that hurts. So they'd have that. Also, because of the position they would be in, their lungs would slowly fill with fluid until they would slowly suffocate to death. That was many times what actually caused death, was suffocation. Some people who have really done a lot of research on this, you know, Matthew writes four words. There's people who have written four books on just the experience of crucifixion. And I didn't get into too many because it's You can't read all of the information that's out there. But evidently, because of the pain and the scourging that would have happened, you'd be severely dehydrated and swollen up. Some would die of thirst. Some would die of a loss of blood. Also, this messes with your nerves. And I guess it would at times feel like someone would grab a nerve in your body with pliers, twist it, and remove it from your body. Which, as I read that, I thought, well, that doesn't really help describe anything. You know why? Because none of us have had that happen. So how do they know that that's what it felt like? I don't know. But I can say, we can say without a doubt, this was miserable. This was misery beyond what we've experienced. Okay, I haven't had severe injuries, but I've hurt myself a few times. I somehow managed to put my hand into a table saw, and it was bloody. It hurt. The worst that we've had, the worst you've had, it just doesn't come close. It just doesn't. But Matthew doesn't focus on it, so I'll leave that there. But Matthew does say, you know what? And then the soldiers, they gambled for his clothes. Which just seems kind of weird. For one, why would they do that? If you remember, Jesus had nothing. Okay, so whatever he owned wasn't very valuable. So that says to me that they aren't doing this because Jesus' clothes were so valuable. They just figured, hey, you know what? We've killed and tortured and beat him. Let's sit here and play some games as we watch him die. Let's grab the cards. Here, the winner of this one gets a shirt. They're entertaining themselves. And why does Matthew bother to tell us this? Because even in these guys' wicked actions, they are fulfilling a prophecy. Even in their wicked, terrible actions, they are proving the sovereign control of God. Because way back in Psalm chapter 22, it is recorded that this would happen, that they would gamble for the clothes of Christ. Verse 36, sitting down, they kept watch over him there. And they put up over his head the accusation written against him. This is Jesus, the King of the Jews. So they didn't just crucify him and walk away. They sat down and watched. You know, for them, crucifixion was routine. Another execution, another criminal. And here it becomes a show for them. They weren't guarding him out of concern. They were entertained by his pain. They were indifferent to his agony. They didn't care. I hope that's not true of us. We don't care. You know that movie that this clip was taken from? Lots of people went and saw that. Lots of people were entertained by that. This isn't meant to be entertainment. Never was. So they watched him with apathy, indifference, and he died with purpose. Verse 37 is kind of interesting to me because it says that they put this sign above him, right? Jesus Christ, King of the Jews. And when you put the when you read all the Gospels, you find that they wrote it in three different languages so that everyone passing by would be able to read this in their own language. And the Jews didn't like it. You can actually read that this was Pilate who was responsible for having this written. And the Jews were mad. They're like, wait a minute, Pilate. Wait. It's not supposed to say Jesus, the King of the Jews. It should say Jesus, who says he's the King of the Jews. And Pilate basically says, yeah, what I've written, I've written. I'm done with this. Just leave me alone. What I've written, I've written. Now, the Jews, they wanted something like this written to humiliate Christ. And instead, they write biblical truth for all to see. This, in a way, could be like the absolute shortest summary, a very incomplete, but a short summary of all of the New Testament. This is Jesus. He's the King. For all to see. Verse 38. Then two robbers were crucified with him, one on the right and another on the left. And there's a lot that could be said about these robbers, but Matthew doesn't record it. We'll talk about them whenever we get to the Gospel of John and the Gospel of Luke, you know, 20 years from now, the pace that we go at. So we can't say too much about them, but there is a robber, one on his left, one on his right. And in Isaiah chapter 53, verse 12, you can read it. It says that Jesus was numbered with the transgressors, with the sinners. So there he is between two convicted criminals. Robber number one, Jesus number two, robber number three. There he is, identified with sinners. There he is, righteousness of God becoming unrighteousness. There he is identifying not just with their sin, but with ours. Make this personal. Not just with their sin, but with ours. Verse 39, reading to the end now of our passage for today. It says, and those who passed by blasphemed him, wagging their heads and saying, You who destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross. Likewise, the chief priests also mocking with the scribes and elders said, he saved others, himself he cannot save. If he is the king of Israel, let him now come down from the cross, and we will believe him. He trusted in God. Let him deliver him now, if he will have him. For he said, I am the Son of God. Even the robbers who were crucified with him reviled him with the same thing. So you read those five verses. You read those five verses and you find everyone going by Jesus is just insulting him. Right? It says those passing by are like, you said that if you destroyed the temple, you could rebuild it, but you can't even get off the cross. And then the chief priests come and it's like, you say you trust in God? Well, then why won't God help you? And then even the criminals get in on it. Those who actually were criminals are criticizing Christ. So this isn't just physical agony, but he's surrounded by a storm of insults. A lot of commentaries will use the term a chorus of contempt. Everyone's hating on him. Everybody. The passersby, the scribes, the Pharisees, the soldiers, even criminals. You'd think that people would be mocking the criminals too. What was it about the criminals that was so different that they didn't care about? Well, Galatians tells us that the cross of Christ is offensive. Galatians chapter 5, verse 11 tells us that the cross of Christ is offensive. Why? Well, because we're the ones who actually deserve to be up there. The ones mocking are the ones that should be there. But Jesus is there instead. And he says nothing. He didn't fight back. He didn't defend himself. He could have, right? Instead, he endured it. Every word of mockery would be temptation to get down, right? Every time where they're yelling, you trust in God, but you're going to stay up there. If I was Jesus, it's like, let me prove to you once and for all, I've had enough of this. I know I came here to save you, but if you're going to treat me like this, forget it. Sorry if you're shocked by the sinfulness of your pastor, the not Christ-likeness, but that would be my reaction if I'm Jesus. I've had enough of this. All I did was love you. All I did was serve you. You have life because of me. And this is how you treat me? But he doesn't. He doesn't say, forget you guys. He doesn't say, you know what? I left heaven. I left the perfection of heaven for you to do this to me? No. He stays there. He stays there. And what was it? What was it that kept him there? You know, we think, well, there was three nails, one driven through his feet and one through each of his hands. That kept him on the cross. No, no nails could have kept Christ on the cross. So what was it? Love. And again, we know it. We know it was the love of Christ that kept him there. We're so familiar with it that I don't even know if we care. Why does he do it? It wasn't because he couldn't come down. It was because he wouldn't come down. Love for sinners. Love for the mockers. Bring this home. Love for you. Okay? Love for Noel and Hans and Peter and Kay. And I'm not going to go through the whole list, but I should. Because it's love for you. Real love. Real love. That's what real love is. Laying your life down for the ones you love. That's what the Bible says. So real love isn't what you see on Valentine's Day. I don't know how many of you like walk around Cebu on Valentine's Day, but the Philippines seems to love Valentine's Day. I've got a friend who owns a restaurant, and he told me that he makes more money on Valentine's Day than he makes in like 2 months combined. Everyone loves Valentine's Day. Oh, and you see it's flowers and chocolate and stupid hearts and decorations. If you like Valentine's Day, that's fine, but it's not real love. It's not real love. I don't know how many of you have ever dated someone, but if you ever dated someone, especially when you were younger, like if you were younger and you were dating someone, and I hate to even use the word dating because it probably was not as real as you think it was, but you're so consumed by it. Like, you can't do your homework because you're thinking about this girl or this guy. You can't concentrate on anything else. You can't talk about anything else. Your friends are just sick of you. It's like, if you talk about this girl one more time, I'm going to punch you in the face. But you're all consumed with it. I don't know if you know this, but Jesus is way, 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 way better. Sorry to offend your crushes, especially some of you are actually dating in here. Sorry, Jesus is better. You need to know that. And you know how I said I looked up words to describe how terrible it was what the soldiers did? So then I thought, well, how can we describe how much better Jesus is? How can we describe this amazing love of Christ? You can't. There is nowhere near enough adjectives. I had to double check that adjectives are describing words because grammar was not my strong point. Adjectives are words used to describe. There's not enough adjectives that you can string together to describe how amazing the love of Christ is. And you can watch the image and it fails to show how sacrificial his love was. Okay, it's not just sacrificial, it's more than heroic, it's more than selfless, it's more than relentless, it's more than unshakable, it's more than undeserved, it's more than unthinkable, it's more than incredible. And I stopped. I gave up at that point. I read some more and I was like, it doesn't work. And I can't persuade you to this. Maybe some people could. Maybe there's preachers out there that could persuade you. I can't. But he can. Jesus can. I hope, I pray that you have been persuaded by a love that's willing to absorb wrath, a love that will endure the mockery, a love that bleeds for his enemies, a love that doesn't quit, a love that even under the weight of nails being driven through your hand and severe shame endures. That's divine love, love that holds nothing back. So the question before us is, have you been persuaded by that kind of love? And not just impressed by it, not entertained by it, not familiar with it. Oh yeah, I know, I've heard Jesus loves me. No, persuaded, changed. Because when you truly know beyond head knowledge what Jesus endured, why he chose to stay, and you know Christ, it demands a response. Isaiah 53:5, but he, speaking of Christ, speaking of the coming Messiah, was pierced for our rebellion. He was crushed for our sins. He was beaten so that we could be whole. He was whipped so that we could be healed. Guys, it was the only way. It was the only way. So let's trust him. Let's not doubt. Let's thank him. Let's spend the rest of our life loving him in return for the love that he offers to us.